We're going to look at another couple of texts that Vidya Devi sent us. And one of them is an extract from a talk called Looking Ahead a Little Way, which was a talk that Bhante gave on an order convention in 1999, so that the year before he formally handed on for the first time to the sort of first generation of the Preceptors College. And the second bit of text that we're going to look at, if we've got time, is a more recent one. It's from an essay called Blake and the Gates of Paradise, and that's from September and October 2017, so a couple of years ago. A couple of comments, maybe just by way of introduction to the text. What we've been trying to do over these few days in the study period is just take a few moments from Bhante's life, moments of more than usual significance for him, and moments of significance also for us. And the last of these, kind of obviously, was Bhante's death just about a year ago, a little less than a year ago, on October 30th last year. I mentioned this already, but just sort of thinking about this, it was hard not just to go back to the event itself. I've mentioned this before, I think, even on this event. But we were on the last week of what we called the international course. It was about, I don't know, maybe a dozen order members from different parts of the country. And we were just introducing the last week, Monday morning, and an ambulance turned up in the courtyard. And it was Bhante being taken off to a hospital in Malvern. Turned out over the course of the day that he had sepsis. And even though Bhante, even though us collectively have been anticipating Bhante's death probably for a couple of decades, you know, still finally that moment where the ambulance left, and just 12 hours after he went, an email saying how seriously ill he was, and then just a few hours after that on the Tuesday morning, an email saying that he had died. And I remember getting the email and just thinking, what's the appropriate response to an email saying that your teacher has just died? And anyway, it came up that the appropriate thing to do was to sit down and meditate. So I sat down in my room, just started to meditate, reflect on the news. And actually, I was really surprised what happened in the meditation. That, like, my meditation isn't given to ecstasy, but it was quite an ecstatic meditation. I was just sort of sitting there reflecting on what had just happened, and it was this very spontaneous, very strong experience of, at this point, I'm not trying to argue for the profundity of it, but a little bit of a loss to explain exactly what it was that was going on. Extremely positive. And partly, I think it was just a kind of an upwelling of gratitude, you know, and just feeling how much my life had been, like, shaped, really, what was most deeply important in my own life, in the shape of my own life, had entirely come from Bhante's own experience of the Dharma, from his teaching of the Dharma. So there was that experience just of appreciation and of gratitude. But again, this is me sort of trying to articulate something that I'm not very articulate around, but it was almost like I was surprised that there wasn't, I'd kind of expected a sense of loss. And actually, at least in that sort of first response, there wasn't much of a sense of loss. Starting to feel a bit like Pingya and Pingya's praises. But it was almost like I felt I was touching a little more clearly, a little more deeply, a little more centrally than usual, that experience of the Dharma. And it was almost like that's the ground on which my connection with Bhante was most central and most deep. And it was almost like the essential relationship of me to my teacher, almost a bit sort of paradoxically, was stronger and clearer in that moment than it was in my usual habitual relationship to Bhante, being around and working with him. It just felt like this very strong connection with what was most essential in my relationship to Bhante, what had been given from Bante, and rather than a sense of loss, it was just this sense of connection on that essential ground of experience of the Dharma, something like that. And to be honest, pretty much that's carried on. I've missed Bante practically a few times. There's things that have been quite tricky that I really wished I'd had a chance to sort of talk through with him and to get his take on it. But I think that sense of appreciation of and even connection to that current of the Dharma pretty much has carried on. In the few days that followed, the whole team here was focused on preparing for the funeral. And again, it was an extraordinary atmosphere. At the funeral itself, we had a few people who had come from other Buddhist traditions and people that I knew fairly well from work through Network of Buddhist Organisations, European Buddhist Union, and so on. And we had them, I think Parimi and I hosted them over in the sitting room in the men's community. And they were remarking what a positive atmosphere it seemed to be. I think they were a wee bit puzzled, actually. They'd come to the funeral and there was something quite intangible in the air that was extremely emotionally positive. And the whole community had felt like that in the week building up to it. And again, trying to sort of describe what it was this sense of a group of people in pretty good relationship with each other doing something that clearly all of us felt deeply, all of us really responded to from some depth and wanted to do what we needed to make sure that the funeral, that the ritual of the funeral was as, I don't know if successful is quite the word that you'd want to apply to a funeral, but just so that the profundity of the moment was given an expression that was sort of adequate to it as far as possible. It was an extraordinary sense of harmony, extraordinary sense of cooperation, an extraordinary sort of, again, something far more emotionally positive than you might have anticipated after such a significant loss. Yeah, so a very strong experience of Sangha. It was also quite a challenging moment, like for me personally. I don't know how it was for other people in the community. I don't know how it was for each of you. But what I realised was that, you know, in a way, I've had access to Bante in some way or another, whether through individual meetings, whether through studying his writing or hearing his talks. I've had some kind of access to Bante's experience since my first connection with the movement in the early 70s. And what I realised is that sort of vicariously I've had access to a depth of spiritual experience that is absolutely obvious, is deeper than my own. You just have to be in conversation with Bante and you're aware that you're engaging with an awareness so much subtler, so much deeper than my own. And vicariously, I've always had access to that. And it was a little bit of this sense of realising that his death meant that I no longer had vicarious access to that depth in quite the same way as I had. And realising I'm going to make this a collective thing because I don't want the responsibility just myself, but realising me, our generation, had to step into that space, that if we were going to carry on as a tradition, able to carry on communicating the Dharma in a way that supported deepening spiritual experience, our generation had to step into that depth of experience that in a way Bante for me had always been the guarantor of. So it felt like quite a challenge as well as a deeply positive experience. So maybe that brings us on to a couple of the themes that Bante anticipated 20 years before and looking ahead a little way. And I'll start off. It's a great opening to the talk. Bante says, I believe that the order and the movement has a future. Right, that's the opening. So that must have been reassuring for all of us in the audience in 1990. But then he goes on to say, that's not to say that necessarily you will have an easy time. And don't know how far your experience has borne that out. But he goes on to say that the movement, not just the movement, but the Dharma in its articulation in these times is going to meet opposition. It's going to meet resistance and it's going to meet difficulties. He describes some of the difficulties in the wider culture. But then he goes on to say that even greater than the obstacles and the dangers from outside is the danger from within the order. So he says that the biggest difficulty, the biggest obstacle is a danger from within the order. And then, very simple idea, he says the danger, in a word, is disharmony. And I want to take this kind of seriously. It's a deceptively simple idea, I think. When I was reading through this essay, it reminded me of the Tuscany retreat that I had been on in 1985. And I remember Bhante doing a Q&A in that retreat and being asked what he thought the greatest risk facing the order in the future was. I don't remember the exact word, but I remember being surprised. But the gist of it was he thought that the greatest danger facing the order was competition and friction between order members, and that the greatest risk was disharmony. So it was interesting. First of all, I was surprised in 1985 that he saw that as the greatest risk, and interesting that he came back to that in this talk in 1999. So Bhante goes on to say in the 1999 talk, human beings being human beings, there will always be differences of opinion. There will always be personality clashes. So that's just a given. But then he goes on to say, but these should be resolved as soon as they arise. And then, again, I don't want to kind of over-egg this, but in the talk he says, resolving those clashes should be an absolute priority. And again, quite strong language if you take it at face value. It reminded me of a conversation that I had with Bhante a few years ago, and I had been involved in trying to sort out a bit of conflict between order members at a centre. And the conflict had got so intractable and so kind of stuck that some of the order members involved had given up on it and just said, look, it's not going to go anywhere. I don't want to pursue this. I don't want to engage with it. And in conversation with me, Bhante was surprisingly strong about it, and he was saying that he thought that decision not to engage was ethically very serious. And the way he talked about it was, he said, at the point of ordination, you make a commitment to harmony with friends and brethren, brothers and sisters in the Dharma, and to decide not to do what you can to resolve a conflict was actually not honouring commitments that you made at the point of ordination. And again, it really struck me how strongly, how kind of ethically seriously Bhante took the necessity to engage with, to resolve disputes and to resolve disharmony. In the 1999 talk, he goes on to say that resolving them does not necessarily mean that we just go on talking about them. He actually says sometimes talking can just prolong a conflict. And then he says sometimes it's best simply to intensify our practice of the Dharma and leave the problem to resolve itself or to look after itself. And at this point, the talk changes gear. Right, so again, you've got Bhante talking to a group of order members 20 years ago, and the order 20 years ago probably wasn't an awful lot more spiritually advanced than it is these days, or a lot less either. And it's like the request, the demand, the communication to the audience goes up a notch. And Bhante goes on to say, he talks about deepening practice and intensifying practice. And the terms that he uses to explain it are that this means order members making a wholehearted effort to move from effective going for refuge to real going for refuge. This is the language that he used. And real going for refuge, in other words, he says, to achieve stream entry. And then he says that in the order, when that happens, so it's been pitched quite high, when that happens, he says, a radical transformation in the nature of going for refuge takes place. the going for refuge ceases to be my, in single inverted commas, going for refuge. I, in single inverted commas, cease to go for refuge, and something else takes over, at least to an extent. It's interesting, there's a little switch here, so he's been talking in terms of going for refuge, talking in terms of stream entry, and I'm aware of previous essays of Banti where he's cautious about trying to draw too close correspondences between different frameworks, but actually here he does it pretty explicitly, and he says, when something else takes over, at least to an extent, in Mahayana terms, this something is the bodhicitta. Even he talks about the real bodhicitta. So he's talking about a deepening practice to the point where the self-clinging, the self-identification is being loosened, is being softened enough, is being seen through enough for something else to take over, and that something is the real bodhicitta. And then he goes on to say, there's no question of the arising of the bodhicitta being, single inverted commas, my arising. I, single inverted commas, do not develop the bodhicitta. I am not a bodhisattva, any more than it is I, single inverted commas, who really go for refuge. And then he goes on to say, are trying to describe what it is that happens. In both cases, he says, we can only describe what happens as a non-egoistic stream of spiritual energy, perhaps even consciousness beginning to take over. So again, it's set quite high. And then he goes on, I want to focus on what happens when a number of people achieve this non-egoistic going for refuge, this non-egoistic arising of the bodhicitta, when that stream of non-egoistic spiritual energy starts manifesting through a number of people simultaneously. And then he says, at that point, there's no question of conflict. And what will start to arise is something for which we have no expression in English, but it will be a true Sangha. So you've got Banti talking to the order and basically saying, you've got to start developing real going for refuge, setting up the conditions for the arriving of real bodhicitta and coming into relationship on that basis, that that's how the order and movement has a future. Just try to think how best to respond to that. We did a bit of study in the college a few years ago in a text called the Chetokila Sutta. It was studied quite widely, so people are going to imagine be familiar with the Chetokila Sutta. But one of the things that's interesting about the Chetokila Sutta is that it's a bit like a Shakespeare play. It deals with a couple of big themes that are central to creating spiritual community. And first of all, it does it at the highest possible level. It talks about Dharma, talks about the teacher, talks about the Dharma, talks about the Sangha. And then it moves it into a much more grounded register. And it talks about the teacher, it talks about our individual specific practice, and then it talks about our actual relationships. And one of the things that was said when we were studying this is that actually both perspectives are necessary. The text talks about the practitioner needs not to be doubtful or uncertain, undecided or unconfident about the Sangha. And if you're not doubtful, uncertain, undecided, unconfident about the Sangha, your mind inclines to ardour, devotion, perseverance and striving. And one of the points that was made is that this trying to articulate what the Sangha is, trying to be clear in our own mind what it is that we're moving towards, trying to sort of describe, trying to evoke what that quality of relationship looks like, is a sort of necessary, what was it Banti talks in one of the papers about, you need a sense of the ideal, an imaginative connection with the ideal beyond self-clinging. And what you're doing when you're talking about the Buddha, what you're doing when you're talking about the Dharma, what you're doing when you're talking about the Sangha, is you're trying to evoke as strongly, as clearly as we can in our own experience, this imaginative connection with reality beyond self-clinging. It's trying to get something clear enough in our own minds to give ourselves experiential access to it. But then the Chitokila Sutta changes register, and it says that it's only when a practitioner is not angry or displeased with his companions or her companions in the spiritual life, not resentful and callous towards them. It's only when you're not displeased, not resentful, not callous, that your mind can incline towards ardour, devotion, perseverance and striving. And I suppose partly it's my own inclination to always want to ground the evocation of the depth into something kind of grounded and something that I can work with in my own experience. I think in the Chitokila Sutta, you get that balance so well and so clearly. So the question for me is, having evoked that image of moving in our own experience from effective to real, going for refuge and starting to set up relationships between ourselves that express that and support that, what does that look like in our actual developing relationships? And excuse me, I'm drawing in texts that are not the ones that we're studying, but I've been really struck in the last few years reading Bhante's commentary on the Karaniya Metta Sutta, in particular, partly because insight has been such a big discussion in the order in the last few years. One passage in particular has really stuck in my mind from the Karaniya Metta Sutta commentary. And in that, Bhante says, a common misapprehension is to think of insight and egolessness in abstract or even metaphysical terms, rather than in terms of concretely lived attitudes and behaviour. Realising the truth of egolessness simply means being truly and deeply unselfish. To contemplate the principle of egolessness as some special principle that's somehow separate from our actual behaviour leaves it as far away as ever. If you find it difficult to realise the ultimate emptiness of the self, the solution is to try to be a little less selfish. And then he goes on to say that the understanding comes after the experience, not before. And I just found that such a kind of concrete, accessible way of thinking about the move from a self-referential relationship to experience to something, realising the ultimate emptiness of the self, with the understanding coming after the experience of being a bit less self-referential. So he goes on to say in the Karaniya Metta Sutta commentary, talking about the word Karaniya, and the word Karaniya comes from the Pali word, means literally, this is what to do, or it comes from a word meaning action. And Karaniya, it gets translated in some of the texts as something like, this is what needs to be done by somebody skilled in the good. And what Bhante goes on to say is, we talk about metta as a feeling, but actually it's not a feeling. It's more precise to think about it as a volition. We can't choose how we feel, but we can choose how we choose to act in relationship to how we feel. And Karaniyam, what that's getting at, is advice to us about how to act in response to our experience. And basically it's a recommendation to start to respond to ourselves, to start to respond to others out of this relationship of friendliness, of kindness, of an aliveness to what it is that's trying to emerge, and how we respond to each other in a way that supports that emerging process in ourselves and in others. And it's a choice. You can't choose how you feel about what we encounter, but we can choose to respond in a way that supports that emerging process. And Bhante goes on to say that the language of the sutta, and even the language of Buddhism generally, he says, is conditional and not imperative. It's not an insistence that this is what you have to do, but it's saying, if you want to set up a certain quality of experience, this is what we're advised, this is what we're encouraged to do. And this, maybe I hope, brings us on to the second bit of text that we've got this morning, which is an extract from Blake and the Gates of Paradise. I'm just going to quote sort of briefly from this, but the Gates of Paradise is a second half of a little couplet of Blake's, a little aphorism of Blake's. And the Blake verse is that mutual forgiveness of each vice, such are the gates of paradise. Mutual forgiveness of each vice, such are the gates of paradise. So there's a whole essay on this that I'm not going to try and unpack fully. But one of the things that Bante writes in this, and he's obviously reflecting on his own experience, it comes after some of the stuff that he wrote earlier in the year, but he says, "We've all been guilty of indulging this or that vice, great or small, and we all have to forgive those who have trespassed against us before asking for forgiveness for ourselves." What Blake is saying is that true forgiveness is unconditional. There's no question of laying down terms and conditions, such as we forgive this person their trespasses only if he or she repents and apologises for what they've done. Otherwise, forgiveness is no more than bargaining. Forgiveness is a free act of the true individual. And then he goes on to say that what Blake says about mutual forgiveness could hardly be more suitable as a motto for a spiritual community like Tri Ratna. And I suppose the reason I think Vidya Devi sent this, the reason that I wanted to mention this, is if we're trying to look at our relationship to each other in a way that brings us into connection, that acknowledges all our quirks, all our complexities, all our faults, and also recognises what it is that's spiritually central in our own practice, spiritually central in what we share, what does that relationship look like? And I think Bante quoting mutual forgiveness of every vice as a motto for a spiritual community is a kind of interesting bit of advice, I think. Going back to the 1999 lecture, Bante finishes it with a bit of an exhortation. And he says that the order and the movement has a future only to the extent that it's such a sangha. And such a sangha, in this case, meaning based on that deepening spiritual experience, something of that access to a non-egoistic stream of spiritual experience and the kind of harmony that comes from that. He goes on to say, "It's therefore imperative that each and every one of you seek to transform your effective going for refuge into real going for refuge and the arising of the real bodhicitta." And he finishes off handing, again, maybe at this moment of reflecting on Bante's death, the end of the talk is Bante saying, "It's up to you." So it gets passed pretty explicitly to our generation. And I suppose the question for me is, the request from Bante to us is, how do we set up the conditions for our own deepening intensification of practice? So Bhutti talks somewhere about the conditions for the arising of the bodhicitta, and he talks about intensification of practice, a lifestyle that supports focusing on that kind of depth. And he talks about collaborative relationship with each other, serving something bigger than ourselves. It was my experience of working here in the community after Bante's death, of what that harmony feels like when you're working so concretely to serve something that each of you feels is important. And again, if it's not presumptuous, I think everybody in this room is involved in the project of making your own strengths, even your own weaknesses, the service of making the Dharma available. And I think just that question of what is it that supports our own deepening experience, and how do we come into relationship with each other in a way that recognises, responds to, supports that emerging depth in each of us. So Bante goes on to say that it's only to the extent that a sangha creates such a nucleus that it's got a future. And it's maybe not just there's going to be one nucleus or a single nucleus. I suspect that in the order, in the movement, there are contexts that bring people into relationship with each other where we start to relate and away from our own depth of experience as far as we can, and we try to come into relationship with each other in a way that supports that emerging process. But if it's not too kind of clunky to be saying this, it seems to me that part of the job that we've got to do, it's not just strategically identifying the needs of the movement, it's not just sort of figuring out what the priorities are for our area, that the real crucial thing is how do we come into relationship with each other in a way that acts out of that connection with our own emerging bodhicitta, that recognises that in each of us, and that we consciously try to create the kind of harmony, that the kindness, forgiveness and relationship to each other. Subhuti says somewhere about don't cling to your own particularities. Recognise what your own character has to offer. Make your strengths available and let your weaknesses be covered by the strengths of the people that we're working collaboratively with. And in a way, let's figure out how do we create the kind of nucleus, or how do we contribute to that in a way that supports that emerging process that means the order and the movement as a future.